Vampire shows are making a comeback, and the anthology show Black Mirror has a few new episodes. We're going to talk about things that disturb me on this episode of Pop Life.
Digital content on WAER is supported by SRC Incorporated, a not-for-profit research and development company whose goal is to bring a focus of respect, teamwork, and the freedom to innovate to the workplace. Learn more at srcinc.com/WAER.
Welcome to Pop Life. I'm Joe Lee, the podcast that's all about pop trash. It seems like just yesterday that the vampire genre was having a popular run. HBO's True Blood and the string of Twilight movies were on fire, and those movies were riding the coattails of the likes of Blade and Underworld. But for the last 4 or 5 years, the bloodsuckers have been hiding in the shadows. Until now. We'll explore the vampire comeback in just a few minutes, but first, the Netflix anthology series Black Mirror is back with 3 new episodes. If you aren't familiar, Black Mirror is a British television series now available on Netflix that are standalone dramas that can often be very disturbing, at least to me. Helping me get to the core of some of my fears is Dr. Kendall R. Phillips, professor of communications and rhetorical studies at Syracuse University and author of Projected Fears, Horror Films and American Culture. Welcome back.
Hey, Joe. Always good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I want to get to some of these the things that disturb me. A couple of things that disturb me. We're going to talk about Black Mirror because it's not in the horror genre. It's more sci-fi, but it disturbs me because some of the things that go on, they're warnings to how humans interact with, rely on technology. A lot of those things appear to be sort of close to happening, or in some cases happening.
Yeah, and that's, I think, what makes it more disturbing. I'll go out on a limb here and say that there are no vampires or werewolves, and probably not zombies, although when classes start here at the university, you sometimes think they're zombies. But but the idea of, you know, a technology that changes your perception or hacks into your memory or changes, you know, the way you see the world, the way you interact, that is here.
It is.
And it's not that far from, you know, the next step.
It's not. It explores a twisted, technology-dependent near future where technology intersects with some disturbing human instincts. What disturbs me, again, is how close to reality it is. So there's a string of these, and there's one in the new 3-episode release of this season. There are a few of these that deal with connecting technology directly into the human brain. And interestingly enough, just last week, week before last, I saw an article that said Tesla's Elon Musk is about to announce at some point that he's found a way to connect a computer to the human brain. Here we go. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know.
Here comes the Matrix, folks.
Here we go. I mean, so you take a look at one of the newer releases. It's called Striking Vipers. It's a story of two college buddies who reunite after not seeing each other for a while. They have a favorite video game that's called Striking Vipers, but there's a new release of this video game that allows you to connect directly in. So it plays heavily on not virtual reality, but augmented reality. And you can experience the characters of the video game. You can experience what they're experiencing, right? So you can it's a fight game, so you can experience the punches and the kicks and all that stuff. It's a really interesting, challenging episode. We're going to take a tiny bit of, we're going to listen to a little bit of the trailer for it.
I love you too.
There's something going on.
Something going on.
That's what I said.
Not 1 minute more.
Nothing is going on. It's a promise.
I promise that nothing's going on except there's something is. So here's the synopsis. The characters that are chosen in the video game, the fight game. One is a male and the other is a female character. And so they're experiencing what these characters experience. After fighting, they work off some stress by having sex, right? So you got two guys playing the characters or representing the characters. The characters are having sex, and the two guys are experiencing what the video characters are experiencing. And then there's some confusing feelings that, about, you know, questions about, am I gay or is right. this just a video game? It's a really interesting thing to think about in terms of augmented reality. And you know, it could be a sign of where this technology is going to a place where you can experience something and you begin to not be able to differentiate reality from fantasy.
Sure, which I think, you know, in a way is very much our experience of the virtual world. So even go back, you know, I can remember the years of chat rooms and forums, and people would go on and you'd choose a name. I'll be Joe and I'll, you know, create an identity. And it was as if this was entirely fictional or virtual, but you still got angry or mad at people or had friends there or felt like you had a relationship. I mean, I know people who fell in love through these kind of interactions. So you start to say to yourself, even in the more sort of digital as opposed to the augmented reality we're in now, the virtual world is real.
Yeah. The, you know, these things I read all the time about how video games can be addictive. This is speaking to that because this does become a bit of an addiction. They're sneaking around, or at least sure. the one married friend is sneaking around to play this game. And there's a funny scene at the end where they have to meet. The one guy, the married guy, has to meet his friend, and he has to kiss him. Because he doesn't know whether or not this is real. And it's like he has to know. And it's so funny because he kisses him and he says, well, yeah, no, I don't feel anything.
Yeah.
But they continue to be addicted to the game.
Sure.
They veg out to this thing. And it sort of ends with him sitting on a couch, eyes glazed over in this virtual or augmented reality world. You know, it's just one of those things that is, I find, disturbing. There are a few other episodes, again, that are piping directly into the brain. Season 3, Episode 2, Playtest. It's a thrill-seeking globetrotter who's backpacking through Europe. He's asked to or invited to or he applies to test a terrifyingly advanced video game. Here we're back to video games again.
Always video games.
We're back to augmented reality. This uses an implant behind the ear, and it really puts the user in the video space, and it just feels so real. Have you seen that one?
Yeah, no, I think, and it's funny. It's an interesting trope through Black Mirror of the idea of the video game and the playing and the losing of reality. And the other for folks who haven't seen it is Bandersnatch, which mm-hmm. is also a video game that becomes the Black Mirror movie where you can choose your own adventure.
Right.
And there's apparently infinite number of possible paths through it, but it's a very similar thing that we get lost in these sort of experiences.
Yeah. Now this one, they put him in a haunted house to see how long he can last, and they throw all kinds of scary things at him. There's a spider with a human face. There's some murderous-looking dude running around in there. Just things that are that we're used to in traditional horror movies, the surprises.
Sure. The classic kind of gothic stuff.
Yeah, what's coming around the corner and all that stuff. But just in a matter of seconds, now this thing plays out for the course of the show an hour. But in reality, in just a matter of seconds, this guy's brain fries. It can't handle the amount of information that's being fed to it. It can't handle the reality or the appearance of reality of that video game. And he goes into a vegetated state, and that's how it sort of ends. And they toss him aside, and they figure out what adjustments they're going to make to
next,
the video.
Come on in. We've got another candidate.
Exactly.
It's not real. He's a sort of mental projection. You can see him. I can't.
Wow. Oh, okay.
Give him a whack.
Give him a whack? Oh, okay. All right. Oh,
just like whack-a-mole. Mm-hmm. I've played it a million times. Okay.
Playing whack-a-mole, it's cute at the beginning, but then they throw the horror stuff
at
him.
It's all fun until the spider comes
in. Until the spider comes, and it is, again, a very good episode, one of my favorite episodes, but disturbing. Another, Season 3, Episode 5, Men Against Fire. Future soldiers must protect frightened villagers from an infestation of vicious feral mutants. Now, in this case, the participants are unknowing about how they're being used. And so in order to desensitize the soldiers from the mission, the killing that they have to do, the government uses augmented reality to project human beings as virus-infestant mutants.
Yeah, it's almost like vampires.
Right. So you can disassociate yourself from the killing that you have to do. And in this case, the people who are being portrayed as mutants develop a device that disrupts the signal in the brain so that the soldiers will actually see them for who they are. And this one soldier, you know, comes to realize that and is unable to perform his soldier duties. And the government holds that over his head because they're going to still use the technology to play over the killings that he did over and over in his mind until it just so we have a situation here where that kind of technology is being used against us as citizens.
What I found the most chilling, and sorry for the spoilers for people that haven't seen this, but it's been out for a long time, so you have no excuse. But what I found really chilling about that episode, The Men Against Fire, was when they show Stripe, who's the sort of main character, the video of when he chose to become a soldier and chose to have the implant. So that ultimately, which is very similar to Playtest, throughout Black Mirror, the characters make a choice to accept this technology, to have it implanted or put over their head or plugged into them. And there, the really chilling part is at the end, when he has seen what he's done, he ultimately has to make the choice to re-accept the virtual reality so as to not face the horror that he's actually experienced.
You know, the little message there, though, is we do it every single day that we hit we tap a button that says, I accept these terms.
Yes.
When you the pages and pages of terms when you're getting an iPhone or downloading an app or something, it says we don't read that stuff.
No.
And that's how he was treating this. Was like, yeah, I don't care. It sounds cool
sure.
to me.
Go ahead.
Let's just go do it.
Accept. Click.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. I found that to be, a very disturbing episode because the technology is being used against us, but not in an overt manner.
Yeah.
Again, it's deceptive. A lot of great messages in there.
Can I make one political point about that? And this may be too political, so I apologize if people don't want politics. I'd say go away. But so I was just a few weeks ago in Turkey doing a project working with Syrian refugees. And I came back to see news stories about Syrian refugees portrayed as if they were – essentially as if they were monsters or some sort of contamination, these people coming across the border and invading Europe and causing trouble. But the reality is these are people in need. These are people who – everyone I talked to had been a doctor or a lawyer or a journalist or whatever whose life was disrupted by a massive war. And so even though we haven't plugged the technology into our head, we've let ourselves politically and through the media – look at other human beings who are in need and say, ooh, that's them. We don't want them here.
Right.
They're not like us, but they are.
Yeah.
And this episode of Black Mirror really plays that out and says, yeah, we're doing this every day.
For years, we've been susceptible to propaganda, and this is using technology to just make it that more effective. Season 4, Episode 3, Crocodile. It's probably my absolute favorite episode of the entire Black Mirror series. One woman harbors a deep, dark secret, while simultaneously another harvests people's memories of an accident when their worlds sort of collide.
Do you mind if I ask you a few questions?
What does that do?
This accesses your own memories of what happened. I don't care what you do in your own time. Private stuff is private stuff.
So I want to be careful about how I discuss this one because this one does have an element of surprise at the end. And if you haven't seen it, I really don't want to spoil it for you. But what we have is one woman in her youth, I think coming from a concert or something with her boyfriend. They accidentally her boyfriend is driving. He accidentally hits and kills someone on a bicycle. Right. So because they were under the influence of alcohol or drugs, they decide not to call the police, even though it's an accident. And so they just dispose of the body and go on about their lives. Parallel to that, after you know, years have gone by and the young woman has now become
very successful architect.
Very successful architect. She witnesses a accident. Yep. Just an accident. A automated pizza truck hits a guy. You know,
and shouldn't there be automated pizza trucks? I just feel like that was what I got out of that episode.
But there are. Like, I think they're working on that. I swear to God, I read something not long ago where they are actually working on these automated delivery and pizza trucks.
Then I would be happy.
So anyway, she witnesses that, there's an investigator, insurance adjuster, who has the technology to read people's memories. They put a little sort of halo on your head, and they can read memories. And so she's trying to get information from the guy who was hit, and now she has to find witnesses to the scene. So the problem with that is it allows you to see, you know, all the memories, not just of that event. And she uncovers an incident in the other woman's hotel room that I really don't want to talk about because I don't want to spoil it. But the way that they get to the end of this thing, it's a domino effect of murder and tragedy. And the discovery at the very end is really surprising. Now,
totally chilling episode. As you watch someone sort of a series of bad decisions just get worse and worse and worse. And it's really it is not uplifting. This is not a happy-go-lucky Black Mirror episode.
It was a jaw dropper to be sure. But again, we're tapping into using technology to tap into the human mind. There's another I'll talk just quickly about. Season one, episode three, the entire history of you. People have an implanted grain, what they call a grain behind their ear, which allows them to record everything they see and hear. This guy sees his wife. He enters a party, house party, sees his wife having a conversation with a man. You and I would feel a little normal jealousy.
Hey, who's that?
Yeah, who's that? You know, and we might play some scenarios over in our head. But what if we had technology?
Replay that.
To dig a little deeper. And that's what this is all about. He digs so deep that he does uncover his wife having an affair with that guy based on the memories that he's able to obtain through these devices. And it ruins his life.
Yeah.
You know? I'm sure his wife ruined his life by having an affair, but, you know, might have gone on without.
Sometimes you don't need to know.
You don't need to know. So, again, Black Mirror, not in your wheelhouse and specialty of horror, but it is something that disturbs me because of how close to reality we are getting with this thing.
Well, I would say, you know, from a kind of horror perspective, and I think there's a lot of horror elements here, and some of them are much closer to horror and some are a little more silly and fun. But what really Black Mirror operates on is like Gothic literature, and particularly, you know, two aspects. But so in classic Gothic, there's like the world of day where we're rational. And then at night, that's when the things come out, whatever they might be. And here you have the exact same, almost every Black Mirror has kind of normal life and then the introduction of some technology. And then we end up in this other side of the mirror or the technology. So the difference, it's the same Gothic idea, just instead of it being ghosts or the supernatural or the devil, now it's technology.
Right.
And the other thing I love, kind of Gothic trope that plays out in a lot of Black Mirror, is the unreliable narrator. So if you look back at classic, like 18th, 19th century Gothic literature, often it's written in first person and the person keeps saying, I don't know if I'm going crazy, but I swore I saw a monk floating in the sky and I don't. And so in Black Mirror, in episodes particularly like, you know, Archangel or Playtest or The Men Against Fire, our main character doesn't know the reality they're in.
Right.
And so we as the audience are also trying to figure out, is this real? Is this not real? What is reality? What's not reality? And so I think what Black Mirror has done really smartly is to take that very traditional kind of form of supernatural storytelling, update it, transform it into technology, and tell us really fascinating stories that are really about us now more than anything else.
Yeah. Very interesting stuff. If you are not familiar with Black Mirror and you are a fan of science fiction, a fan of anthology, a fan of drama, I think you'll really like it. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk to Dr. Spooky about the recent slate of vampire shows.
On the latest episode of The 315, Joe Lee and Kevin Kloss chat with Lydia Knox of CNY Central about her impression of Syracuse as a new resident.
The thing that I love about around here is there are so many bodies of water, small or large, like Lake Ontario. I mean, people say when you go up there, and I've been a couple times, it looks like the ocean. You can't even tell. It's a great lake. This sounds silly, too, but I like Wegmans and how people are so big into that.
Hear the full episode at WAER.org.
You're listening to WAR's Pop Life. I'm Joe Lee, and he's Kendall Phillips. The vampire wing of the supernatural genre has occupied space in the collective American consciousness for a very long time, the narrative changing and evolving along the way. Like other narratives in pop culture, it comes and goes in popularity. It seems like vampires are on the comeback. Kind of went away for a little while.
They had to go in their coffin for a little bit. Now they're back. They're feeling rested. They're ready to rock and roll, man.
Yeah, they're hiding in the shadows, and now they're back. There were three shows this year in particular that I never know how this stuff works in Hollywood. Does like someone get wind of someone developing something and says, "Oh, we need to do that too." It's ironic that three sort of vampire related shows comes out in one year. So it's interesting to know how these ideas develop, but. AMC has a show called Nosferatu. It's in its first season. It's been renewed already for a second season. It stars Zachary Quinto and Ashley Cummings. It's based on the novel by Joe Hill, who is Stephen King's son.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And the series is created by Jamie O'Brien. The protagonist is Vic McQueen. She discovers that she has the supernatural ability to track the immortal Charlie Manx, who feeds off the souls of children in a twisted Christmas village where every day is Christmas. The one of the things that I like about this, that Joe Hill did not want to play on traditional vampire tropes.
Right. So there's no blood sucking. There's no turning into bats.
There's no fangs. There's no I'm allergic to garlic.
Yeah, no cape. It's a whole
anything like that. But I wouldn't call it a scary show, but the storytelling is pretty good.
Yeah, I think to me it's more of an involved adventure story, and will she figure it out and will she make it, as opposed to things popping up out of the shadows or sudden violence and things like that.
Yeah, sort of reminds me, it's in the vein, not literally, but in the vein of True Blood.
Vic McQueen might threaten Christmas lands, but no one has ever been able to enter except me.
You're the only one with the power to stop him. And I'm gonna burn Christmas land to the ground.
What's happening to me?
He can't be far.
Bad people ought to be punished. There's a nice list and a naughty list. And she's not on my naughtiest.
Nosferatu.
Yeah, don't get on the naughty list. Don't Just advice on. For everyone out there.
So, you know, Christmas Town, nice, naughty list. I think Zachary Quinto's a very talented actor. I enjoy him playing Spock in the reboots of Star Trek, and he's kind of perfect for this sort of a weird guy role.
Yeah, he absolutely, if it wasn't for him being so perfect at chewing the scenery but still being menacing, then this whole thing would just fall apart.
Yeah, I'm four episodes in. I'm enjoying it so far. I think it's a pretty interesting thing. Again, sort of like True Blood in that there is some element of goofiness to it. It's not all serious, not all dark. I think the storytelling is pretty good. The next is A Discovery of Witches, which is a British TV show now airing on AMC here in the U.S. It's based on the All Souls trilogy by Deborah Harkness. stars Teresa Palmer, who's a witch, and Matthew Good, who's a vampire, whose characters team up despite long-held mistrust between witches and vampires to protect a sacred, bewitched manuscript from the magical world. It's kind of on that Twilight tip.
I feel like it's like Vampire Diaries meets Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like she falls in love with Angel, and it's the Slayer, this feels like if I was maybe 30 years younger, I would be maybe more into it.
Yeah, it's not my cup of tea. I got through two or three episodes, and I was like, you know what? I'm not a Twilight fan. This is not my thing. If I'm going to have vampires, I need blood. I need
and no
carnage.
Glitter. No glitter.
No glitter. And then Fox has The Passage. Now, it's based on a trilogy of novels. A dangerous virus has been developed by scientists and federal agencies meant to be a cure-all for all diseases, but it kind of gets out of hand. A botched U.S. government experiment turns a group of death row inmates into highly infectious vampires. An orphan girl might be the only person able to stop the ensuing crisis, canceled after one season. Now.
it's a good novel. For folks that want to read, the Justin Cronin novel is quite good. I watched the first few episodes of the TV show and couldn't help but feel that maybe this should have been left a novel.
Yeah, you know, the issue, and I watched actually most of that first series until, now I'm a DirecTV customer, and DirecTV has some dispute with Fox, and so they left me hanging. My Fox channel went away.
Yes, mine too.
And so I'll have to pull it up on my app to finish that season. But the problem I had was they just weren't getting to the action soon enough.
Yeah.
There was too much cops and robbers and, detective or former agency member against the agency kind of thing, and more about his relationship with the little girl who he's sort of adopted, and less about the vampires. I want to see the vampire stuff. Yeah. I want to see how they're going to get out of hand.
To me, this is one of the things about TV today, that the difference between, say, Netflix or Amazon or HBO and traditional broadcast networks, a network like Fox doesn't want one season of The Passage. They want 8 or 9 or 11 seasons of The Passage. So they have to kind of try to tool this out.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you get something like Netflix or Amazon, they're very happy to do 4 episodes.
Right.
Or one episode's 40 minutes, one's 55, one's 65, because they don't have to fit into that traditional parameter. And so they can sort of tell different stories. And then if we like them, they can figure out the second story.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like The Passage was just trying to milk this out to get to season 10.
Right. So we have a comeback of vampire shows, some successful, some not. There was another Fox show a couple of years ago that was also based on vampires and a virus. And
The Strain.
The Strain in New York City. I watched that. I was mildly entertained by that one. But
now, can I add one that's on now or just finished that you might not have seen? And so it's called What We Do in the Shadows. Okay,
no,
this is I think it's on FX. Forgive me because I DVR everything, so I actually don't know what channel anything's on. So there was a film made by Taika Waititi, who's the director of Thor Ragnarok, New Zealand director, and he made this film called What We Do in the Shadows that was a mockumentary about a group of vampires living in Wellington, New Zealand, which is the equivalent of living in like Manlius.
Okay.
I mean, so this is not like they're living in some great Gothic. They're living in some suburbs, and it's very, so they've transported that idea. So it's like a reality. It's almost like The Office, and you've got this group of vampires, and it's very funny. And there's now they moved to America, so they're in Staten Island, which of course is exactly where you expect the vampire infestation to happen. But if people want a funny take on the vampire tropes, and they play with all these ideas, and the one quick thing I'll say is there's one vampire who doesn't drink blood; he feeds on people's energies, and he is that guy in The Office who walks up and you go, oh God, not, no. Hey, Joe, how's your weekend? You know, I was thinking about the stapler you were using and you know, there's some new kinds of stapler. You go, oh, and that's literally, he's like feeding off of you. So if for folks who haven't found What We Do in the Shadows, I think it was renewed for a second season. It's absolutely, when it hits its moments, it's absolutely hilarious.
I got to check that out. So why has the vampire thing been with us for so long? I mean, we can go back to before Bela Lugosi.
Oh, sure.
And classic black and white movies. The just the storytelling alone, the fairy tale or horror stories or whatever alone has been around about Dracula and vampires for a long time. Why is this still in our imagination, do you think?
You know, I think it's a few things. I do think that Bela Lugosi variation is what really caught the imagination, because, you know, before that, if you go back and look at the 1920s film Nosferatu, there's no seduction. Like, no one's picking up Nosferatu in a bar, like, unless you've just had way too many. I mean, this is a really disgusting, horrible person with fangs and a big nose and bald head. And it's like, but Bela Lugosi comes by and adds that seduction. Mm-hmm. And so you look at Bela Lugosi and you go, like, he's scary, he's evil, but I kind of would, you know, like, kind of cool. I mean, what the heck? I'm here, he's here, let's see what happens. And I feel like that has been for most of the successful vampire films. You know, you get those two strands. You get the vampires, like in The Strain or in The Passage, where they're absolutely repellent, mm-hmm. horrible infestation creatures. And then you get this other that is the kind of romantic strand, right. which is...
So, when you have something that's been around for that long, you got to tell the story a number of different ways. So we do have the sexy vampire. Yes. We do have comedic vampires, like you just mentioned in that new show. And then you have the absolute horrible monsters. Yeah. And so there, and everything in between. So it is the kind of material that you have a lot of room to play off of, and you can change the narrative in terms of vampire culture, like in True Blood, assimilating into modern society. You have infestations, you have viruses. So it's an interesting thing. I want to talk about the fact that vampires bother me, and so. I'm going to be honest. I'm going to put my cards out there.
This is a shocking revelation, folks. We just found out vampires.
This is a little intimate thing to know about.
So talk to us,
Jolie.
What's the
vampires are the only nightmare that I have had and still have.
Oh my.
Nightmares. So whenever I have a nightmare, a true wake up sweating, oh my God, I'm glad that was a dream kind of dream.
Yep.
It's usually got a vampire in it. I don't know what it is. So,
do they glitter?
They don't glitter.
Okay, so that would be, I think, okay, that's good. Because my nightmares, they glitter, and they kind of have dewy blue eyes and say, you know, romantic things. And
no, it's usually I'm trying to fight one off and I can't.
Sure.
Right? Because they're super powered strength and they got all
they're
kinds of mental.
They're here to consume you.
Yeah.
They are sucking the life
out
of you.
But I've not been able to figure out. I think I've traced it to a traumatic episode in my life, which we'll talk about in a second, and that has to do with sort of vampire movies that are either favorites or things that have impacted you. So we'll talk about that for a second. My favorite vampire movies are Interview with a Vampire, which came out in 1994, stars Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt and a very young Kirsten Dunst. And then Bram Stoker's Dracula in 1992 with Gary Oldman, Keanu Reeves, and Winona Ryder. And then as a teenager, I really enjoyed The Lost Boys, 1987 with Jason Patrick and Corey Haim and Corey Feldman. But the one that impacted me, which I think is why I still dream about them today, was a movie called Salem's Lot.
They're breeding on one another. The vampires are creating vampires.
The monster wants you.
It's a geometric progression. 2 × 2 × 4 × 8.
There's a dead man upstairs.
Bill!
Yet you though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil.
Look at me. Ned Tebbett's body has disappeared from the morgue.
Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Bill!
So it's based on a Stephen King novel. First of all, I love those old movie trailers.
Oh, they're great. No,
I just love, they don't make movie trailers like that anymore.
No one screams like that anymore. That's the problem.
It's based on a Stephen King novel, stars David Soul and Bonnie Bedia. A novelist discovers that a vampire has taken up residence in his New England hometown. Now, the scenario is this. I'm living in Baltimore. I'm a young, maybe I'm a teenager. It's 1979, so I'm about eighth grade or something like that. My mom's watching television. I just stumble into her room. I don't know what's on. And I settle down in a chair and I'm watching. All of a sudden, this vampire-ish kid floats up to a window and they let him in and he starts sucking on people's necks. I mean, that back then scared the crap out of me. I mean, I would watch that now and find it, because of the production values, hilarious. But back then, it really did scare. And I had nightmares after that for quite a while. And I continue to have nightmares about vampires. Do they impact you like that?
No. But I'm glad we've had this time together. Your time is up. Please schedule another set. To me, the iconic moment for me was the 1978 film Halloween. That was the one. So the serial killer slasher. But I do think, and I actually think those films in the 70s, there were a lot of made-for-TV horror films. We forget. We don't get made-for-TV films anymore, right? Salem's Lot was one. I think Duel was one. There were a lot of Gargoyles was one I remember.
Love Gargoyles.
Really, again, really cheap, but smart and scary and aimed probably more at us as young kids than, you know, the parents. But they were, you know, in some ways they were dealing with, I mean, Salem's Lot's a pretty shocking film. A child dies. He's turned into a vampire. Like, you don't kill a lot of kids on TV. Like, that's not something the FCC is a huge fan of.
Right.
So it's not surprising those things hit you, particularly as a young boy, thinking, oh, wow, I'm young. He's young. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. This could be my future.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Spooky. Thank you. Thank you very much. So do you have some favorite movies or shows?
I do. You know, I think there are some really wonderful vampire films. Again, you've named several of them. There are a lot of vampire films everyone sort of knows. But the one I wanted to mention is probably a little lesser known. It's by a very prominent filmmaker, Academy Award winner, Kathryn Bigelow, who people probably know more from The Hurt Locker. But early in her career, she made a fabulous vampire film called Near Dark.
Caleb Colton no longer belongs to our world.
We give him a week, see if we can call him one of us.
He belongs to hers.
But you have to learn to kill.
He belongs to theirs.
I don't want to kill.
He makes a kill tonight.
And they all belong to the night.
It's $3 short for a bus to get home.
And they all belong to the night. Again, you don't get trailers like that anymore. Now, when you mentioned that to me, I didn't know anything about that film, and I certainly didn't know that that was a part of the Catherine Bigelow's film history. So, So what is this about? What connects you to this movie?
I think, again, sort of background, I grew up in sort of rural Texas, and this is mostly when you see vampires, they are either monsters living in the sewer, or more often, if they're human vampires, they're wealthy, they're well dressed, they're living in townhouses in, you know, Boston or Baltimore for that matter. But these were redneck, kind of poor, lived in a van, went from motel to motel on highways, very similar to the highways that I grew up on. And so it's like working class vampires.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Paxton, a great actor who passed away not too long ago, Lance Henriksen's in it. It's got a great cast. It's very smart. It really draws in the vampire mythology. But I felt like it really makes it a little more grounded in reality, not quite so supernatural and wealthy and these kind of aristocrats. But it's like what vampires would probably be like. They would be traveling from town to town, feeding when they could, staying in the shadows, living in motels, as a lot of people in this country are, sort of drifting around.
Yeah. I'll have to pull that up, see if I can find a full version of that and take a look. There were some – and now that we're talking about sort of youth, and I've gone into my deep issues with Salem's Lot, there was another that impacted me too. It wasn't a vampire movie, but an episode – of I miss shows that actually used to get me going like that. Remember The Night Stalker?
Oh, you know, you talk about what hit me. I remember as a kid, they used to rerun The Night Stalker at like 11:30 after the news. And I would stay up or sometimes sneak out of my room to go back to the living room, turn that on just to watch and then be terrified and then not be able to go back. End up sleeping on the couch because I was too afraid to go back to my bedroom. Yeah, great
I loved that show. It was I can't remember if he was either a detective or an investigative
reporter.
He was
an investigative reporter.
And, and it really did go through all the sort of classic monsters, and including vampires and Dracula. So that's another one that got me back then. Man, this was really cool. I want to thank you for talking to us about this and helping me work through my issues.
I hope you feel better. You know?
I feel better. These things will continue to disturb me, but I think maybe disturb me just a little less. Do you have a favorite episode of Black Mirror? How about your favorite vampire movie or show? Let us know about it on the Pop Life Facebook page at Pop Life WAER. Pop Life is a product of WAER Syracuse Public Media. Our producer is Kevin Kloss. Before we let you go, let us pay tribute to actor Rutger Hauer, who passed away on July 19, 2019. The blue-eyed Dutch actor appeared in numerous movies, including The Osterman Weekend, Lady Hawk, and The Hitcher. I will personally best remember him for his role as the self-aware android Roy Batty in one of my all-time favorite movies, the film noir sci-fi classic Blade Runner, directed by Ridley Scott in 1982, where he played opposite Harrison Ford. Roy Batty's dying words at the end of Blade Runner captured our imaginations and challenged us to think about artificial intelligence, life, and consciousness. We wish him well on his journey. I'm Joe Lee.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time. Like